This is Neighbors.
Together we will stand, fight and we'll fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, Toby.
Now, now, people, say now together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man.
Good morning and welcome to Neighbors on KUMD. Neighbors is KUMD's effort to get some interesting folks in to talk about these challenging times. Our COVID pandemic, how is it affecting you? What are different organizations and individuals and groups doing to cope, to make things better, to help us care for one another? And how can we join in that conversation and pool our mental, intellectual, and psychological resources? This morning, our guest is political scientist and global health expert, Dr. Jeremy Ude. He is of UMD, but news media from ABC, U.S. World in News Report, Washington Post, and he did remark, a personal career high point, Rolling Stone, have gotten in touch with him to talk about the pandemic and how to make sense of it. He joins us this morning as our guest here on Neighbors. Jeremy, good morning, and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Lisa. Thank you so much for the invitation.
You know, you have talked about so many different aspects of this crisis that it's really kind of hard to narrow it down in terms of what should we be talking about. And also, things do keep changing. But I had asked you, what do you feel is the most important thing for us to be talking about? And you identified, how do we move forward now? And it really seems as though those conversations have kind of moved to the fore. The people that feel as though economically they can't manage any longer without things reopening, without businesses reopening. And what appears to be the science on the other side that says, no, this can't happen yet. It's way too soon. You're putting yourself and other people at risk. Do you think, to begin with, that many people, when they think about reopening, they're saying, I'm not worried about me, I'm fine, I'm not going to get sick, but they're not thinking that extra step about other people in the community who might be vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a unique virus, in part because it's something that we haven't seen before. So there's so much that we're still learning about the basic epidemiology of how the virus is transmitted, who might be able to transmit the virus to someone else. And, you know, this idea that there are these asymptomatic carriers out there, that I could be one, you could be one, that we could have the virus, not even having the symptom, but inadvertently spread that disease to someone else. So I think that, you know, that's hard then for people to oftentimes get their, to wrap their minds around these sorts of consequences. But then I also think we're starting to see those conversations, or people having their own internal discussions around, okay, let's say that they allow movie theaters to reopen, or they allow for concerts or things like that. You know, do I really feel comfortable at this stage being able to go out and do those things? Do I really think that that's something that you know, I want to spend 2 hours in a movie theater, or I want to get on a plane and be in this, you know, weird metal tube hurtling through the air with a whole bunch of people who are coming from who knows where. And so there's this tension, and it's a completely understandable tension, where on the one hand, we really want to get back to our normal lives. And you see that in the polling, you see that in the public opinion that they can express. But at the same time, that those same public opinion polls are showing that people are, even though there's a lot of pain that goes along with this, and that's something that is very real and genuine and we need to take very seriously, people are also saying, but I'm at this point, I think we need to make sure that we are being cautious, that we are not inadvertently giving ourselves the opportunity to go back to normal life, which then redounds back to us and leads to a second wave of this virus, or leads to more people getting sick.
I heard of a bit of a fascinating conversation yesterday that had a frontline medical professional from Bellevue Hospital, I think, in New York City. And this person said that they were flabbergasted looking at the protests. And their take on the protests were that these folks had not seen what this doctor had seen. and that the pandemic had not hit home to them in their communities, maybe toward, you know, maybe closer to our area of the country, the middle of the country, that they had not seen what was being experienced in New York and some of these other communities, and that they said the wave is coming for you too. It's going to come and it's going to happen in your community. This person was surprisingly, I think, kind and kind of understanding, but just saying, I can see that it has not become real to you in the same way that it's real to us, but it will become real to you.
And that's one of the things that makes this so much more challenging, is that we know that we're not going to see one big nationwide crest of this wave, and then everything's going to retreat at the same time, just because of the way that the virus came into the country, the way it spread through various parts of the country, and the very different responses that different states and localities have had to the virus, means that even though things may be looking like they're going well in the New York area right now, you know, we're probably still a few weeks out from hitting that peak in other parts of the country, like here in the Midwest. And so, you know, we're going to see those happening at different times. And that's going to be frustrating as well, because you might see some changes in the policies or the restrictions on gathering being lifted in one part of the country. And we may be really anxious, like, oh, I want to be able to get together with my friends and family, or I want to be able to do these things again. And why can't I quite do them yet? And a lot of it is because, well, we just haven't quite hit that point yet. It's not that we won't hit that point, it's just that we haven't yet hit it.
The idea of who do we listen to has become so much more fraught than it has ever been, but the stakes are higher than they have ever been. The messages out of the federal government are conflicting, many times in direct opposition. Sometimes they change regularly. The messages that, you know, each governor is sending to the people in their state are different from state to state. I'm curious. I have not heard a lot of criticism. I have, and I wonder sometimes if that's, of course, is affected by just the people that I know and that I talk to most often. But generally across the board, I'm hearing that Minnesotans feel that Governor Waltz is doing an excellent job in his handling of the pandemic. Do you agree with that? And if so, what do you think it is he's doing that is engendering that response?
I would agree. I think that the overwhelming response that we've seen to Governor Waltz and his response, and just sort of Minnesota's response to COVID-19 in general, has been overwhelmingly positive. Not to say that it's universally positive, but, you know, no policy ever gets universal praise. But I do agree that there's been a strong level of support for Governor Waltz. And I think there are a few things that are contributing to that. One is that we are seeing consistent messaging from political leaders, but also from public health officials. It seems like, you know, when Governor Waltz and the head of the State Department of Health and the other leaders who are doing these daily briefings for Minnesotans are, you know, singing from the same hymnal, if you will. They are reinforcing what they're saying, that they are on, that there's a consistent message that is coming through clearly from these different officials. So we're getting a consistent message. That's one thing. The second thing is just that there is this ongoing communication, that this is something that is happening regularly. And so we're getting these updates on a regular basis. And just having that line of communication, that open line of communication, is so important in these sorts of public health interventions, because, you know, for most of us, we don't know what we should be doing. We don't necessarily know what the right sorts of responses should be. We don't have the same sort of data that they have. So it's important to have that ongoing conversation happening with the officials who are making these decisions. But the third thing that I think that Governor Waltz and the rest of the folks in Minnesota are doing that has been so useful has been providing the data. Like, they're kind of walking us through the data that they are using. Here's why we, based on these data, these are the decisions that we are making. Here's how they are affecting the sorts of choices that we're making. Here's how they might be having an influence on when we might be able to go back to past practices and, you know, be able to reopen non-essential businesses and all these other parts that go into the shelter-in-place orders. And so we know we can understand the decision-making process in addition to just hearing a consistent message. We know kind of how they're making their decision. And I think, again, that's just very reassuring because, again, there's the sense of, all right, they're getting good information. They're getting information that is coming from reliable sources, and we can see how that information is then being translated into policy. And that's something that you know, I don't know that we've really been seeing at the federal level. But it also speaks to just the odd way that we do public health in the United States compared to other countries. Public health is very much a decentralized idea here in the U.S. So at the national level, there's not really a ton of public health power that exists. It's really at the state and local level. And so this is an issue area where it's really important that states step up and do this sort of good work. And so not only is this something that is uniquely within the state of Minnesota's wheelhouse, if you will, but it's also something that they're doing really well by just being very open and honest with Minnesotans. And I think that's really been working really well so far. And, you know, we're coming up to the end of this current shelter-in-place order, and I just saw a story right before we got on the phone here that looks like we're probably going to have the K-12 schools closed through the rest of the year, and so that, you know, that's part of this ongoing discussion. But the fact that we are having this as an ongoing discussion has been really useful.
As a journalist and a citizen, I have wanted and been frustrated for decades with the idea that all of our communication with government is not conducted this way. I can see where there are some perhaps smaller issues where you really can't take the time to sit and parse every single thing for people. And yet, so many decisions, it seems, are made in secrecy, and nobody wants to let anybody know what they're doing because they don't want to tip their hand or they want to get the credit or blah, 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 blah. But this open, regular, honest communication, I think everybody can think of a situation in their own life or in their own experience of being a citizen where they'd say, you know, if you had just told us what was going on and been in better communication with us, it would make all the difference. Because sometimes, even if you don't hear the answer you want to hear, just the fact that somebody is talking to you about it makes all the difference.
Right. And that's where I think Governor Waltz has done a really good job. Even if you're disagreeing with the decisions that he and his administration are making, you know how they're making those decisions. And so having that openness, but also just having that level of respect for your citizens, for all of us who are, you know, who are subject to these policies, having that level of respect. Like I value all of you as citizens, as residents of the state of Minnesota, to be, you know, to be able to handle this information, to be able to be engaged in this sort of process and understand how your government is working. That's been really good. And it's something that I hope, if we do have some takeaways from this experience, we'll see that there actually is a good opportunity for this sort of give and take, for having this very transparent sort of process.
I think that would be absolutely wonderful, and I love that idea that you mentioned of respect. As you said, you can disagree with the process, but you can't say, you know, oh, he's an idiot, he just got up, you know, this morning and made the decision on a whim, because the steps and the information leading up to the decisions have been laid out to people. And it strikes me that if somebody came forward and said, look, here's information, here's data that you have not considered, that would, you get the sense that would be taken into consideration as well. Somebody'd say, wow, let's take a look at this. Let's see how it affects where we go from here. We're talking this morning with Dr. Jeremy Ude. He's a political scientist, and he's a global pandemic expert, global health expert. He's joining us this morning as our guest. I've heard from friends across the country on social media, as no doubt you have too. Some of them are frustrated because they feel that the people who are sick of the stay-at-home order just want to go out and socialize, or they want to get a haircut, or they want to do something that seems kind of trivial. Other people feel that the folks that want the stay-at-home orders lifted are really in a financial crisis. They're really crunched. They're scared to death about losing a home or losing a place to live or feeding their families. And that's their sense. what is your sense as you're watching the area, Minnesota, the Northland, and then from there Minnesota, and from there the country respond? What is your sense about what is driving a lot of this effort now for folks to kind of dial back these stay-at-home orders?
Well, I mean, I can certainly sympathize with, you know, the idea of wanting to be able to socialize with friends or be able to get a haircut. You know, as I was taking a shower this morning, I was like, oh, man, I really wish I would have been able to get in and see my barber before all of these policies went into place. And I miss being able to go out with my friends or go see live music or do these sorts of things. And, you know, the disruptions to people's their lifestyles, their experiences with their communities is something that's very real. In addition to then, we've also got this incredible economic consequences that are going along with this. You know, this morning's numbers were another 4+ million people who are filing for unemployment for the first time. And almost all of this is a direct or indirect result of COVID-19. So it's absolutely very real that these disruptions to our economic way of life, to our social ways of being in our communities, to all these sorts of things, they definitely have an effect on people. And it's very understandable that people want to get back to the life that they've known. I want to get back to the life that I've known. I miss being able to go to work and seeing my friends and colleagues, and, you know, experiencing all the great things I love about being in Duluth and can't do right now because of these sorts of restrictions. So I don't. On one hand, they make absolute sense. On the other hand, you know, the thing that we have to remember is that the viruses don't care about our timeline. The virus doesn't care about our economy. The virus doesn't care about our social needs. And so, it's, you know, we're in a lot of ways we're kind of subject to what we can do to try to outsmart the virus. What can we do to try to counteract what the virus wants to do? Because we're not going to have a treatment in the next week or two. We're not going to have a vaccine in the immediate term. So we have to do these what they call non-pharmaceutical interventions to try to stop the chain of transmission. And, you know, in the midst of that, then we're all trying to make our way through figuring out how do we still maintain those personal and those social connections that are so important for life. You know, I know that that friends and I will do things like virtual happy hours and just checking in with each other. I'm actually in a lot more conversation with my siblings now than I probably was in the months before this outbreak, in part just because, you know, we miss. When you take away that opportunity to actually be able to get together, it really starts to become something that you notice. So, but that doesn't, you know, that can't replicate the opportunity, the feeling of actually being able to be in person with another person. And so I think a lot of it is just about, this is a really big disruption to all of our lives. And it's not a comfortable disruption. There's a part of me that really thinks about, you know, how, as we think about when we work with students right now, it's thinking about, you know, we need to extend extra grace to ourselves and to students. And I think that's kind of what needs to happen right now. Like, I think for the most part, people understand why we're doing these social distancing measures. That doesn't necessarily make it easier. So you understand intellectually what is happening, but on an emotional level, it can be hard to understand and grapple with this. And then if you are a person who, you know, is worried about losing their home because of being unemployed or losing access to health insurance because you've been put on to unemployment, like, these are very real challenges. And I think this is one of the areas where public policy really plays an important role, not just in the putting these social distancing measures in place, but also in thinking about how can we try to keep people as whole as possible? How do we try to make sure that, even though there are all of these consequences, that we try to minimize them as much as possible?
What are some of the things in your mind that we could be doing either as a community here, as a state, or as a nation? I loved that comment. How do we keep people as whole as possible? The stimulus check, that was certainly an effort. What are some things in your mind can we do to help make, and of course everybody send a thank you note to the people who invented Zoom, but what can be done to help keep us whole?
Yeah, I mean, I think that first effort with stimulus was definitely useful, but is nowhere near sufficient. And in part because this is on such an unprecedented scale that we're just trying to figure out even how big do we need to make something like this in order for it to be effective. Other areas where I think we're really seeing some potential effects are on some of our local small businesses here. And what are the ways that we can still try to patronize those businesses, even when they're not able to, say, welcome customers in as they normally would. How do we make sure that those businesses are still going to be there? We're coming up to summer, and we know that summertime here in Duluth is an incredible time. We've got lots of tourists coming to Duluth or going further up the North Shore. How do we make sure that we still have all these great restaurants and bars and breweries and shops and hotels and everything else that make coming up to the North Shore such a special place for so many people in Minnesota and in the region as a whole? So thinking about those sorts of things, but also then thinking about the sorts of social vulnerabilities and how we can try to address that. I think about my mom, who lives in Iowa, who is older and has diabetes, and so is understandably not going out right now. But that means that you've got someone who's at home by herself for a long time during, hasn't been going out for weeks and weeks. And so how do we try to make sure that we're still reaching out to those other members of our community and just having that sort of acknowledgement, like, I see you, and are there ways that we can try to provide some assistance? I know that in some areas there have been groups that have been formed to help people out who don't feel comfortable going to the grocery store, for instance, to go and go to the grocery store for people and then, drop off the groceries on someone's front doorstep. Just even those sorts of things that go beyond what is happening on a public policy level, but just in terms of building those neighborhoods, building those communities, building those strong social ties within where we live, those are really important because, loneliness itself can be a problem. It can have its own physical and mental health consequences. And so we want to try to avoid some of those as much as we can as well.
Jeremy, let me ask you one final thing that I was curious about. Toward the beginning of the pandemic, an interesting article in Time caught my eye. And the headline of the article was, "Right now, people are pretty fragile. How coronavirus creates the perfect breeding ground for online extremism." Then we saw over the weekend these televised protests, and there were people that were armed, and there were conversations about white supremacists being involved. And all of a sudden, I kind of went, wow, this has moved from online into right out into public. Talk about that a little bit. Is this something that as a nation we need anything more to worry about right now, but is this something that we need to be paying attention to?
It's definitely worth paying attention to, because when we see these sorts of outbreaks or these pandemics and the different ways in which they affect different parts of society, oftentimes they reflect and they exacerbate the vulnerabilities that already exist, or they reflect and exacerbate the cleavages that exist within societies. And so, in some respects, the protests that we saw in the weekend outside the governor's mansion in St. Paul and saw in Michigan and Virginia, Colorado, and some other states, some of that was reflecting some pre-existing political cleavages that exist within the United States. So, the fact that you had people carrying guns, for instance, guns aren't really all that effective or useful when we're talking about a virus, but they were being glommed onto some of these other sorts of gun politics that we see here in the United States. But because this is a time, and these sorts of social distancing measures do then lead to these sorts of changes in how we're relating to each other, how we're able to interact with each other, and it can heighten some of these feelings of vulnerability, then it can start to exacerbate some of these other sorts of things. So again, that's why I think it's really important that in addition to the public policy sorts of responses, that we also have these more community level types of responses, so that people don't feel like they're completely disengaged, or they don't feel like they're being even more marginalized than they might feel like they already are being being marginalized. You know, this is, if nothing else, this is a chance for us to recognize the interdependent nature that we have economically, politically, socially, just as communities as a whole. And strong communities are going to be the ones that are going to be resilient and are going to be able to bounce back quickly when we're able to resume a relatively normal life.
I think that was the article's original premise was the idea that if people are lonely or if they are under stress and they perhaps do feel disenfranchised or left out, that they're going to have the opportunity to spend a lot of time in front of the computer. And I think one of the things that I learned from a conversation with a former white supremacist that I was lucky enough to have a year or so back is that these folks are not just purely idealists. They're predators. And they're very savvy psychologically, and they do prey on people with vulnerabilities. So they're not just expecting to attract people through the purity of their ideology. They are looking for people that they think they can exploit, which I think is something that we don't always think of.
Yeah, and this is a time where a lot of people are feeling vulnerable. They might be feeling like their economic livelihood is at risk, or they might be feeling like, you know, their job is, or their plans for what they were going to do, or, you know, going to college or anything along those lines are up in the air. And so this is a time when those people who might be out there trying to prey on folks, there could be a lot of people out there that are looking for some sort of guidance, looking for some sort of reassurance or someone to lay blame for why they are in this sort of position.
If you have family or friends, and we all have family or friends, I think, once in a while, who kind of fall into that category where maybe to us it seems like they're looking for conspiracy theories or we don't really understand where they're coming from psychologically. Is there a way to reach out to people and to try to connect with people without getting into messy, you know, the kinds of messy social media conversations that start with, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, or where in the world did you get that stupid idea? Or fill in the blank.
Yeah. This is why, as much as things like Instagram and Facebook and Twitter can be incredible, they can also just be horrible at the same time. You know, I would say that these are, you know, if you are seeing people like this in your life, that it's all the more important to reach out to those people, but to do it in a different medium. Don't go, because, you know, those sorts of social media environments can oftentimes lead to this heated rhetoric or lead to conversations going in a different different direction or involving people that are extraneous. But if you can find a way to actually just reach out to them and just even just checking in, not talking directly about the nature of the post, but just checking in, like, hey, are you doing okay? Like, what's going on here? How are you feeling about this? And just again, just, you know, sometimes it just takes that sort of outreach and to be able to provide that venue where someone feels like they can vent a little bit, because this is, you know, this is a frustrating time, and you know, just having that sort of outreach can be a good first step. And then that might be able to open up the opportunity to have that conversation around, like, hey, so I also noticed that you were posting this stuff about this being a conspiracy by the government or Bill Gates or whoever else you're blaming for this. Like, you know, you can start to open up those sorts of things and do it in a way that shows that you're coming from a level of concern for them, that you care about them and that you're looking out for their best interests. Whereas if you're doing this just through the comments section on a Facebook post, that's not always the best place for having an actual emotional and genuine conversation.
Really?
I know. It's hard to believe.
Well, not only that, it seems like it's a lesson that we just have to keep learning over and over and over again. But, yeah, maybe go to that friend and you're kind of wondering, where's this coming from? Maybe go to them and say, hey, let's have a little FaceTime or something like that, and maybe a visit, because the concern can transcend the politics. The concern can transcend, you know, some of these big constructions that we build up in our heads. The fact that, you know, you're my cousin or you're my friend or you're my uncle or whatever, and I care about you. That's the important part. And sometimes that connection just bypasses all the other nonsense. Jeremy, thank you so very, very much this morning for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Now you can say, you know, Rolling Stone and KUMD.
I mean, Rolling Stone was nice and all, but I think this was a much better conversation.
At any rate, thank you so very, very much for being our guest this morning. It was a wonderful treat to talk with you. And thanks again for being our guest this morning here on
Anytime.
Neighbors. Dr. Jeremy Yude joined us this morning. He's a political scientist and global health expert. This is Neighbors on KUMD.